Hi FM, your station of choice since 2008.
Talk about something maybe equally as depressing, but at least we know what we're talking about is what we get. And that is a conversation with Professor Adrian Puren, who is the Acting Executive Director at the National Institute for Communicable Diseases. A very, very good morning to you. How are you?
Good morning. Thank you. I think I'm awake. How about yourself?
Well, we have no choice. But I do feel bad for you because we always do this to you. You always make yourself available, but we always seem to fit you into this early slot. So I do apologize, but but we have come to rely on you and on your information and wisdom. So on behalf of our listeners, I greatly appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you very much.
Talking about the third wave. Yesterday we spoke with Professor Barry Shubb. He was explaining to us in terms of the numbers, the being under 10%, over 10%. All of the things that we look at. To determine it. Can you just take us through that again and tell us where we're at the moment?
Yes, so I know we're talking about the third wave, but technically at the moment for the South Africa overall, we're not in what is called the third wave. And for it to be declared a third wave, we need to reach a seven-day moving average target of about just over 5,600 cases overall. And each province has its own particular target to reach. So for Gauteng, for example, I think it's about 3,000 odd cases is the seven moving day average that's required for us to really be in the third wave. I know the Premier of Gauteng did declare that we were in the third wave, but for all intents and purposes, that our technical definition has certainly not been met. Whereas for provinces such as the Northern Cape, which essentially did not come out of its third wave, still continues to be, have high levels of infections, are in the Free State and the Northwest are certainly, technically in their so-called third waves. So it's really about reaching the 30% of the previous, peak of cases for it to be declared a third wave. I'm sure there are going to be other definitions and modifications of these as it becomes more and more difficult if we expect the waves not to reach the same level as we've seen, for example, in the case of the second wave. The other critical point, of course, is to look at the so-called positivity rate. And those are the numbers of cases over the total number of cases tested that are positive. So in other words, if it's 10%, that means 1 in 10 individuals tested positive. So if you look at a province like the Northern Cape, which has a 20% positivity rate, if not higher, that means 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 persons are infected. So again, one would like to think that in that particular province, testing should increase to really get a good sense of what is actually happening in that province. Similarly, if you look at, say, the Western Cape, they're at about 5%. That means 1 in 20. So they're doing reasonably well in their testing. But once it reaches, say, 10%, then you'd really like to encourage provinces to test much more so you can get a better sense what's actually happening. And remember, not everyone is testing.
Are these definitions specific to the COVID-19 pandemic, or are they well-established methods that would exist given any form of outbreak of any disease? Yes.
So I think my sense would be that these are general principles that you would apply. So I don't think it's necessarily always specific for COVID-19. But of course, there are nuances here in the sense that we know that infections occur and that you may not present with symptoms, for example, so there could be asymptomatic transmission. And it's only a really small group of individuals that are really spreading the infection. So there may be nuances based on the type of model that you have in terms of the so-called transmission dynamics. So for example, when we speak of the effect of R or R0, this will vary by infection, for example. And so measles will have an R of about 15, so it's really highly transmissible. Whereas for COVID-19, the transmissibility. The R is about 2 to 3, for example. Now, of course, it can change. As you know, we have variants in circulation, and that can affect that particular R value as well.
Are we getting any data with regard to the infection amongst kids? Because certainly, anecdotally, I'm hearing of more and more people whose kids are presenting as positive. They're not necessarily very ill with it, but their kids might have got it. Do we understand how this is infecting kids? Is it through schools? Is it from parent to kid, kid to parent? Do we have a sense of that at all?
Again, I don't think children, compared to influenza, this particular virus seems to be behaving differently in children, especially children under the age of, I think, about 10. And when you look at older children, their dynamics, if you like, really simulate or are similar to what we're seeing in adults, although to a lesser extent, less significant. So again, I must say, when I look at some of the data, over the last year, it's not as if children are now more infected than usual. I think they are infected, certainly, but those numbers haven't dramatically changed over the last year. Mm-hmm. In other words, they're not affected to the same extent as adults in particular age groups, let's say the 40 and above age groups, where you do see higher rates of infection.
Just a point for clarity. Does the NICD get involved in the discussions around recommendations for different lockdown levels? Are you called into those conversations?
Directly. I think those sort of decisions and advice comes from what is called the Ministerial Advisory Committee.
The MSC.
And they will then, so the NICD will say, this is what the picture looks like currently.
They'll get information from you. Right.
Absolutely. And they will then look at other particular factors as well, you know, in terms of mobility data, for example. So you can get that from Google, I understand, or some other tools around how people are moving, trying to get some evidence around the use of non-pharmaceutical interventions. So put all those types of pieces of information together, as well as the models. So the models are certainly also a critical contributor around whether or not, you know, the Ministerial Advisory Committee, together with others, so there's a whole hierarchy of advice that ends up with, I suppose, the president calling the so-called family meeting, saying, well, when we look at the picture, all these factors put together says to us that we need to do the following, for example.
In your view, is there any chance of avoiding the third wave?
We can't stave it off. I would like to think that I'd like to still encourage everyone to ensure that we behave in a way that will allow us to try and stave off. But I think there's some inevitability around some of this, unfortunately. However, I think we should still make the efforts.
I think
we also have that.
I think the difference is that even if we can't stop a third wave, we can prevent ourselves and our families and our parents and our grandparents from getting ill. So, that becomes an individual responsibility, which actually all adds to a collective in terms of our own behavior, doesn't it?
But I suppose that's where I suppose it's really critical for the government to make particular recommendations or, in terms of lockdowns or particular actions. For example, they can have a range of tools, and you've seen that in the second wave. For example, in the Eastern Cape, specific districts, you know, were declared to be locked down, to do a third lockdown, a level 3 lockdown in January. So there are those tools, and that's where the government makes those interventions for us to really try and stave off and manage the epidemic.
And that's where we have to leave it. Professor Adrian Puren, thank you, as always, Acting Executive Director of the National Institute for Communicable Diseases.